Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, and welcome to Season 4 of Origin Story. In each episode, we take a word, idea, or figure from history, explain its origins, and talk about how it influences political discourse today. I'm Dorian Linsky, author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute and The Ministry of Truth.
And my name is Ian Dunt, and I am the author of How Westminster Works, and I'm a columnist with the Iron Newspaper.
This is part two on Jordan B. Peterson, where we perhaps weren't sure if it was going to be a two-parter, but it turns out there is a lot to say about, I suppose, the man and the moment. We've come up to January 2018, publication of 12 Rules for Life, his massive bestseller.
We really do mean massive, by the way. I mean, this book, it's like a ridiculous level of success. So at this point, he's like selling out Wembley. He's not operating in any normal academic sense, you know, even as a public intellectual or anything
else.
No. It's proper next level fame.
I mean, if you say like Noam Chomsky.
Yes.
He's going to sell 4 million.
I don't think
Hitchens
struggle.
Sold 4 million of his. You know, God is not great about it, you know.
I don't think any of these guys could, you know, Richard Dawkins, they couldn't sell out Wembley. You know, that kind of level is not open to them, I don't think. Especially not Wembley in every country. You know what I mean?
No, no.
Like it's quite extraordinary. So clearly he tapped into something big. And I suppose it's probably time to look at the fucking book, isn't it?
Well, journalist Vinay Menon from Toronto Star sums up Peterson's worldview. He goes, imagine a Hobbesian view of existence, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish and short, combined with the philosophy of Winnie the Pooh. You're braver than you believe, stronger than you seem and smarter than you think. And I thought, it's obviously a little wounding, but I thought that does sum up its weird combination of like, life is a fucking nightmare. It's just a fast ride to the grave.
Yes.
And yet also, you can be the hero. It's a very strange, maybe unprecedented in the form of a book that purports to give you advice for life.
When I cracked it open, I certainly was struck by the eccentricity of it. Like just the references that are being made very early on. So, you know, there's a lot of young and then, you know, there's a bit of Solzhenitsyn and then it's like the Little Mermaid, you know, and off we go. And you're just like, what? This was not the ride I was expecting it to be.
Pinocchio. Absolutely obsessed with Pinocchio. There's these very earnest bits where he's just going, when Geppetto wishes upon a star. And I'm like, really?
One of the really crucial differences between the first book and the second book is that when he wrote the first book, he hadn't yet watched the Harry Potter movies.
Yes.
Because when he does, fuck me, then you've really got it coming page after page of that stuff. It's very badly written. Let me take this passage, which I think is pretty indicative of a lot of the writing. In late 2016, I traveled to Northern California to meet a friend and business associate. We spent an evening together thinking and talking. At one point, he took a pen from his jacket and took a few notes. It was LED equipped and beamed light out of its tip so that writing in the dark was made easier.
Could you stab that in someone's neck? Sorry.
Imagine how clearly you could see the veins.
Okay, so he's very excited about the pen.
Just another gadget, I thought. Later, however, in a more metaphorical frame of mind, I was stuck quite deeply by the idea of a pen of light. There was something symbolic about it, something metaphysical. We're all in the dark, after all, much of the time. We could all use something written with light to guide us on our way. You know what this shit reminds me of? Fucking Alan Bennett doing the vicar bit when we did our satire episode. Well, it's like thought for the day. And in a way, aren't we all like
it's
Ukraine?
It's also mixed with, you know, walking around Ryman's on acid, isn't it?
There's a certain sort of moments where he just reveals these bits of his own thinking or his family life that are kind of shocking. I mean, the most depraved thing he says by far is this. Personally, I like to watch a Simpsons episode at 1.5 times regular speed. All of the laughs, 2/3 of the time. You're like, you fucking sadist. What is this?
Doesn't he have an amazing bit about why Nelson Muntz is essential? Because otherwise you would have a world of sort of impotent whining Milhouses and Martin Princes. It's his only dip into the Simpsons metaphorical universe. But it was like, is that the message of Nelson Muntz?
The thing is, it would not be surprising that he liked anything, because he doesn't really understand what he's looking at. The only manner in which he ever reads a book or watches a film is in order to incorporate it into the pre-existing kind of Jungian archetype machinery of storytelling that he already has. You know, so he has no cultural appreciation, even though he spends pages after pages of talking about these cultural products.
But he doesn't reach for something strange, unusual. You know what I mean? That somebody could just go, okay, look, there's this movie or this novel and this is kind of what happens, this is why it's interesting. So it's like the biggest thing, mm-hmm. the most obvious thing. So the reason he's really into Pinocchio, he basically reveals at one point, is that when his son was little, he watched Pinocchio all the time. Now, my daughter, when she was little, watched Finding Nemo all the time. But I don't keep writing. This reminds me of Finding Nemo. So there's a sort of strange, like in some ways, he's got this huge sort of breadth of knowledge. And it's like, here's Descartes and Socrates and it's in Kierkegaard. And then when it comes to popular culture, it's like, if it's not on the Disney Channel... Or Harry Potter, it sort of doesn't...
Yeah, I don't believe that he's read all of the books that he's... I mean, or if he has, he hasn't understood them. I mean, we spoke about Orwell before. You know, you look, if he has read Plato and Aristotle, it's inconceivable that he would say the things he does about Christianity establishing Western culture. I mean, you just wouldn't say it because you would just know that is palpably not the case. I do not question the fact that he has seen The Little Mermaid and Harry Potter. I do question whether he has even read, let alone understood what's going on in Plato. His mentions of his personal life are occasionally actually kind of upsetting. Now, there's a story he tells about when he was a kid. This is supposed to be a story about how well his mother parented him. He says he's basically about to have a fight with a kid outside the sort of front door. They're about to come to blows. And his mum comes out and, quote, "She walked right by. I knew that hurt her. Part of her was worried that I would come home with a bloody nose and a black eye. It would have been easy for her just to yell, 'Hey, you kids, quit that,' as indeed she probably fucking should have, or indeed to come over and interfere. But she didn't. A few years later, when I was having teenage trouble with my dad, my mum said, 'If it was too good at home, you'd never leave.'" And you just think, like, man, doesn't sound great
That's
to me.
That's not how that works. What culture just seems anathema to him. He talks a lot about like excess of compassion. This is his main criticism of political correctness, actually, before it gets to totalitarianism. It's like an excess of compassion. And one of the archetypes that he loves is the devouring mother, represented by Ursula the Sea Witch in The Little Mermaid. Mm. And you're like, what? This isn't how like parenting works. I mean, I guess you could be such a sap that you would just let your kid behave like an absolute dick. I guess some people do that. But it's not a wide... It doesn't mean that, therefore, you've got to be, like, super tough.
Okay, so let's say what's good about the book, or rather the effect of the book, which is that there was a lot to be learned by the surge in demand that he received. Huge levels of interest, huge sales, sell-out tours, all of that kind of stuff. And there was a moment there, really, I think, probably for the progressive left to just sort of spot a thing, which is not really about the content, but about the reception. Just thinking, like, hang on a minute, there's a thing here. And incidentally, there really is a fucking thing there. You see it in the performance of boys in school from a very, very young age. It goes all the way through school. You see it in applications to university. You see it in the percentages having college degrees. You see it in suicide rates with men. You see it in friendship rates with men. I mean, 15% of men right now say that they have no close friends at all. There is clearly a problem with this group that is under-discussed in progressive circles, because obviously it feels like for thousands of years, women have been oppressed. Now, after 20 years of correction, you're like, oh, what about the men? And yet by ignoring it, nothing very useful happened, right? So it goes from Peterson. Left doesn't basically just writes him off as a reactionary, I think correctly, for reasons that we'll go into in a moment, but doesn't really try to say, well, actually, there's a group here that kind of probably does need some kind of conversation. And very quickly, you start getting things like Andrew Tate, right? You see, like, Andrew Tate makes Peterson, you know, look like a kindly old uncle, basically. You know, it's just this horrific sort of rapist propaganda that becomes basically the most successful social media account in the world. And in that, there is a really important moral and political message that needs to be latched onto. When you look at the book, I mean, what you're obliged to do is think, well, okay, fine, so he's talking to that audience. He doesn't really make any bones about that. He sometimes pretends I'm talking to a woman here, but it's not. It's quite clear who he's trying to talk to. You think, well, what is it that you are telling them? Is it intellectually sound? And also, will it help men, especially alienated men, insecure men, with their lives? And I think the story that we're going to see, really on the basis of his own experiences, is that the answer to that is very much no.
What I find troubling is, on the one hand, there is a message that people have to take personal responsibility. Mm. You know, tidy your room, walk with your back straight. Right. You know, the world is not here to sort out your problems for you. Mm-hmm. And yet, in the promotion for this book, he really did seem to speak to a certain kind of victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
There was a quite startling comment he made after that an incel terrorist drove his car into a crowd of people, mostly women. And Peterson suggested that perhaps, you know, enforced monogamy was the answer, that there should be some sort of...
Jesus Christ.
And then he kind of backtracked and went, no,
Jesus
I just think,
Christ.
You know, we should encourage monogamy as a social norm. But I mean, I think that is already being encouraged. Plus, he always says, be very precise in your language, mm-hmm. which he obviously wasn't there. And there is a pattern of when a man or somebody on the far right does something bad, that is sort of the fault of the left. There's another quote. He says, if men are pushed too hard to feminize, they will become more and more interested in harsh fascist political ideology. Uh-huh. Sort of suggests that the root cause of the far right is that they are being pushed to feminize. Like, in what way, by whom, I'm not entirely entirely sure. And so this is, again, something that we'll speak to about his, you know, increasingly overt politics, is that when he's angry with the left, with the Marxists and the woke and whatever, that's never the right's fault. They're never, they don't have that justification of a backlash. They are just doing some bad stuff. But then when people on the right or incels do bad stuff, it's sort of because they've been pushed into a corner. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not in the book, but it's all his talking around the book, and that therefore makes you read some of these passages, you know, with a more skeptical eye.
Yeah. Okay, look, so should we break down the argument insofar as it exists and see if we can find any kind of validity in it? Spoiler, we can't. I feel like I'm being quite generous in even kind of breaking it down, because this is not a book that sets out an argument. It is basically a bundle of really quite eccentric, disconnected thoughts from which you can sort of structure a system, a very bizarre system. But as I say this, if you're confused as you listen to it, listeners, it's not your fault. It's because the argument itself is very, very strange and I think deeply unsound. So it starts with this idea of there are these kind of fundamental experiential elements in the world. Like, there's matter, sure, but then there's these ideas that are just as basic as matter. And the primary idea is the binary between chaos and order. Throughout human history, our ancestors have tried to provide knowledge about this binary through the medium of storytelling. So yes, sometimes The Little Mermaid and Disney films, but more often religion. And it's primarily interested in terms of religious terms with Christianity, takes up about, I'd say probably like 80% of the examples, and Taoism, which probably takes up the other 20%. Chaos is feminine. Order is masculine. There's never really any particular effort to try and explain
You know, just
it's a very highbrow version of women be crazy.
Well, they're women for him, they're this sort of unknowable. They're sort of like the glint of knives in an alley, you know, bared teeth in the jungle. You know, it's just they're full of danger, especially beautiful women. There's a couple of passages where he says, you know, beautiful women can destroy a man just by not paying attention to them. You know, they're just this sort of unknowable force. And his prescription for them is basically just get married young, have children young. You know, that's really the full extent of what he has to offer. Men are order and should reflect order. And order is, you know, judges, society, law, parliament, blah, blah, blah. Women represent chaos, which is like uncertainty, being cheated on. There's one line where he says, chaos is when you're at a party and you tell a joke and no one laughs. And I'm just like, yeah, you're really digging deep into your lived experience with that one.
is it just me? Is the vibe really chaotic in here?
It's gone very feminine around me all of a sudden. So that's it, really. I mean, he takes evidence from the natural world. So like the first chapter, which is a very, very, probably the most famous of his chapters, is basically about lobsters and saying, look, lobsters, you know, the males fight each other for shelter and for food. And the female lobsters look at that quite passively and then just pick the winner. And that's the best one. He gets to have his own sort of harem of females. He sort of expands that forward to most animal species. I mean, he says, for instance, the primary hierarchical structure of human society is masculine, as it is amongst most animals, including the chimpanzees, who are our closest genetic and arguably behavioral match. So what are the two things that you get? That's the argument. Mad, but that is what the argument is. And I think there's two conclusions to come to from that. I mean, the first one is that he is not a liberal. He says he's a liberal. And he does occasionally talk about the individual. But that is a conservative argument. This is the argument that we have done things like this in the past and therefore should continue to do it because the past is a guide to wisdom. The quote is, and I think this is the best quote for really his whole philosophy, is it is reasonable to do what other people have always done unless we have a very good reason not to.
Yeah, well, when I wrote that piece for The Guardian and riled up the Peterson fan base, the lobsters, one of the things that they were really angry about was that I had called him a conservative, which I didn't think was contentious. I was genuinely surprised because I thought, okay, he believes in essential ancient hierarchies and ancient wisdom. He's into discipline and sacrifice. He thinks everything went wrong in the 60s. He thinks feminists hate men. And all normal women want to be mothers. And he doesn't really believe that you can change the world.
Yes, right?
Because I
yes,
think he associates right. yeah. the desire to change the world with, like, you know, the horrors of Stalinism and so on. I assumed he was conservative in sort of every respect, the way that he invokes science and zoology. The stories he chooses, you know, he loves Disney stories when they enforce these old kind of patterns and norms. But he hates Frozen, which he thinks is propagandistic because it is about female agency. And now, of course, you know, let's remember that we're talking here about 2018. I mean, he's literally using the word conservative, you know, about himself and his tribe all the time. It's weird that he kind of kept this sort of plausible deniability. I'm a classical liberal. I'm a centrist, you know.
I think there must be something about the word, because I swear to God, so often I'm put on panels, people from like the IEA or whatever, and they hate calling themselves conservative. They love using that phrase, classical liberal. I think he says classic old-fashioned British liberal or something. I think they just find it a more attractive word. But you dig down, they've never done any reading. They don't have any of the actual beliefs. It's just, I think it makes you sound like a more interesting person. And I presume that's what it is in his case. Anyway, he is very clearly a conservative, and it is a conservative philosophy. The second conclusion that you come to from this is, I think, the more troubling one, which is it's kind of gender essentialism, really, which is, you know, that idea that he's portraying, you are a man, therefore you are X. You are a woman, therefore you are X. It's not that different to, you know, what you would see in communism of you are in this class, therefore you are X, you know, or what you would see in fascism for race. It's the idea that there is a true social personality to you by your designated identity, and that your individual mores, whether you might be more feminine or more submissive or none of that. It's just like, no, there is a right way to be a man.
It's like OG identity politics, but they don't call it that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so what should you be doing? You should be tough. You should fight, you know, be prepared to fight with the most. He's quite concerned with violence. He sort of thinks most interactions between men are kind of fundamentally at least have the potential for violence at all times. And you should be ready for it. Part of having your back up straight is you are
tough, you know, you would present. You should not rely, he's very, very clear on this, you should not rely on other people very often. You know, that is not an honorable way to behave. Most women do want to be with a man who is sort of dominant, and there is a really clear insinuation that they want to be submissive socially and presumably in every other way.
He's a bit like that, you know, that meme that went round, you know, while you were going to parties, I was mastering the sword. You know, that guy holding the samurai blade. Like, you know, that particular message to boys and men.
So let's break it down, whether there's like validity. I mean, you can see the flaws quite obviously, I think. I mean, first of all, on the binary, like if you pick any obvious binary, you will be able to find examples of it everywhere. Your binary could be love and hate, or liberty and authority, or selfishness and selflessness, yeah. You know, and you could just do a history of the world through that binary, and people would find lots of examples in their own life that corresponded to it, and it would look quite deep and meaningful because you could find an example from, you know, Sumerian culture and Rome and, you know, French Revolution, whatever. But that doesn't mean it's fucking, it doesn't mean it's meaningful. You know, it's just like you just picked a really kind of primary binary and applied it across everything. And that's exactly what he does with religion. Right? As you said in the previous episode, find whatever you want in religious texts. Hmm. Like if you just the Bible alone, you know, you want to go through it just trying to find examples of you should live your life according to meekness and compassion, you can find those bits. And if you want to say you should live your life according to, you know, rampaging through with a sword and slaying your enemies, you can find those bits as well.
I have to say, if the Bible only meant one thing, you know, we wouldn't have had the Reformation. We wouldn't have Protestants and Catholics. We wouldn't have, you know what I mean? It would be like there would be one monolithic Christian faith that just went, this is what the Bible tells us. Like it's sort of the first thing that one learns about Christianity is that there's an awful amount of competing interpretations.
The stuff about the natural world, I mean, it's basically like someone's watched half of a David Attenborough program and come to really quite extensive conclusions on the basis of it. You can easily, just as you would with religion, find counterexamples. You know, you could look at the mole, which has a reproductive organ that consists of ovarian tissue at one end and testicular tissue at the other. Or you could look at the bonobo. The bonobo, along with the chimpanzee, is our closest, you know, living relative. The chimpanzees are a patriarchal society. They're quite violent. They're aggressive towards other tribes. And they function quite like the lobsters that he was mentioning. Mm. The bonobos are a matriarchal society. The males that the women tend to pick for reproduction are the males that are calm and comfortable around them. It's not about the battling in that system. They very often, in fact, it's kind of part of their sort of social exchange, is to have sort of same-sex sexual relations. In fact, the female bonobos have them approximately every 2 hours. So, I mean, you could look at those examples, right, and go, oh, fine. So we're going to come up with a theory about the gender and sexual fluidity of the human race, right? On the basis, that would not be a very good argument. Why? Because we are not determined by what happens in the natural world. Even if our origins definitely were in the sort of lobster chimpanzee variety, it would not mean that we would have to structure ourselves now in that manner. So it's intellectually flawed. But I think the real thing is not that intellectual flaw. It's that by taking that really rudimentary, fundamental, essentialist view of what you are, and then using it to give advice to people who in many cases are really quite vulnerable and alienated, you are trying to make them fit in a box. And that fitting in a box simply does not work. And as we'll see in this story, he himself becomes a prime example of that.
Well, his essentialism, of course, is key to his hostility to trans people, which is how, you know, he first became famous/notorious. It's extremely obvious now if you check out his Twitter feed or his videos, because, you know, it disrupts this whole belief about the essential differences between men and women. And there's an amazing quote when he was asked about this. He said, you know, you can say, well, isn't it unfortunate that chaos is represented by the feminine? Well, it might be unfortunate, but it doesn't matter because that is how it is represented. It's been represented like that forever. And there are reasons for it. You can't change it. It's not possible. This is underneath everything. If you change those basic categories, people wouldn't be human anymore. They'd be something else. They'd be transhuman or something. We wouldn't be able to talk to these new creatures. Now, he's very confident there. he's very emphatic. Underpinning this and what sort of undermines a lot of his work is this strange view of truth that he has. It's very eccentric. Even one of the essays in this book about John Peterson is very positive. His version of the truth is distinctive personal. We don't know of anyone who argued for it before Peterson. So the basis of it is this an idea that sort of emerges in Nietzsche. The truth is what serves life. Truth is what is useful. Mm. And this is very important in the study of myths. That they are, I mean, it's pretty also clear that he is fairly religious now, but he used to say, well, I don't know if I believe in God, but I believe in the truth of these myths. But the truth, as we said, is like, well, how do you interpret these myths? But his version of Adam and Eve or whatever is the true version because it's the one that is useful to him. He says useful to humanity, but really useful to his view of humanity. And you go, okay, this is what people do with myths or Disney movies, you know, or art maybe. They go, well, this feels true to me. And, you know, it's very hard to say whether it is or it is not. I mean, he draws a very hard line that lying is the road to hell. But I don't know what lying even means according to his definition of truth. Now, I think where it gets very tricky is when he turns to science, because it seems that he sort of sees science, again, as a source of useful truths. So when he's talking about lobsters and chimpanzees, that is an essential truth about the way that the world works across all species, which therefore means that he ignores the other stuff. And that seems to me the sort of the fundamental contradiction in his project is he talks about truth, rationalism, science, and then at the same time, all this myth and mysticism. And where they converge is that the lessons of both science and the Bible and Harry Potter are the view of the world that he holds, which seems awfully convenient.
It's fascinating. It's essentially that he has ceased to recognize the distinction between objectivity and normative statements. Like, what is normative? What you want to be the case becomes objectively true because that's part of the sort of myth-making, the storytelling that creates the society that reflects our traditions and the blah, blah, blah. I mean, that really is a description. We're using nice words for it, but that is basically a description of someone who has gone completely mad.
Quick break to say that Origin Story only exists thanks to our amazing Patreon subscribers. So thank you to Eleanor Green, Lisa Moylett, hi Lisa, Jane, Oshin George, Tom Dunham, and Lily J. We've been actually really overwhelmed by support from Patreon. To find out how you can get a personal shout out on the show, plus loads of benefits, Origin Story merchandise, and each episode a week early, click on the link in the show notes.
He's bizarre on religion because, I mean, he talks about it a lot. But the funny thing is as well, you know, we should talk about his views on religion and politics because it's been a while since I've read anyone be so wrong on just the basics of what they're trying to discuss. The religion section, I thought I was going to lose my mind. It's like every sentence of it is incorrect. It says, the Bible is the product of processes that remain fundamentally beyond our comprehension. No, it isn't. The Bible is a library composed of many books, each written and edited by many people. That is actually correct. Yep. It's a truly emergent document, a selected, sequenced, and finally coherent story. No, it isn't.
No, it's not.
Written by no one, incorrect. And everyone, no, over many thousands of years. The Bible has been thrown up out of the deep by the collective human imagination, no, which is itself a product of unimaginable forces operating over unfathomable spans of time. What the fuck
this
are you talking
This is Jim Morrison mode, isn't it?
This is 100% Jim Morrison.
You know, looking at the stars, isn't it?
And then he goes on to, it's extraordinary what he says. He says, far less barbaric than the pagan societies that operated. You know, it stopped with the barbaric practices. It objected to infanticide, to prostitution, and to the principle that might means right. Really?
Nobody ever died because of Christian dogma.
No, exactly. No, that never happened. It insisted that women were as valuable as men. You know, are you, what, where the fuck have you been? And then the pièce de résistance, finally, it separated church from state. You're like, my God, man. Like, is there no depth to the fucking ignorance?
Another thing he does, which is very annoying, which is he refuses to identify as a conservative, or used to anyway. And then he's really weird about being religious.
Clearly, you're very religious, right? Mm. And so you just go, well, it's okay, very complicated. I don't believe in God, but I act as if I did. Toronto Star interview, right? Mm. In 2018, after the first book came out, asked if he was religious. He said, definitely. He said, I believe we make a decision between heaven and hell with every decision we make. I think that's literally and metaphorically true.
Let's briefly, before we leave this book, just talk about what he says about the enemy, the conspiracy.
My favourite.
So, I mean, do you want to describe? I mean, it's quite hard to give a good description of it.
Okay, so thankfully, it's not just us saying this, right? He knows fuck all about the left, about Marxism.
Yeah, he knows nothing about feminism, Marxism, or postmodernism, which are the three things that he most hates.
So he had an infamous 2019 debate about Marxism with Zizek, where it turned out, he admitted this, that the only book that he'd read by Marx, and I'm not coming this from a well-read Marxist position myself, so, you know, fair enough. All he'd read was the Communist Manifesto once when he was 18 and then again before the debate. That's what he knows. And he said that, right? That's what he knows about Marxism. So he literally, it emerges, he does not understand the distinction between capital and labor. He thinks that capital is like the bosses. Just doesn't understand the idea of unearned
income.
He thinks that the Communist Manifesto mentions violent revolution, which it doesn't, and the dictatorship of the proletariat, which it doesn't. He thinks that Marxists, and this hopefully would amuse any Marxists listening, all agree with one another. Not only do they agree with one another, but they agree with the Frankfurt School, which in fact was in conflict with Marxism in many ways, and with postmodernists.
Well, and the final part is where we really get into a significant spotted bother. Because there's a real attempt in that book. It's quite a dirty attempt, actually, to take famine, genocide in Ukraine by Soviet forces, and to take Pol Pot in Cambodia and the killings there, extraordinary level of death in Cambodia, and sort of take that genocide paint and just use it to just whack red colouring all over, you know, basically any kind of sort of thought since the 1970s. I mean, really Foucault, Derrida, you know, anyone that considers themselves in that sort of related camp.
It is almost impossible to overestimate the nihilistic and destructive nature of Derrida's philosophy.
Mm. And look, the thing is,
are there any Derrida dictators?
Well, I mean, look, his overall concern with that stuff, I don't think is the actual argument itself is not necessarily right. I do think that there is a problem with cultural relativism, and is sort of pretty well understood if you're an academic working in that area. If that's the thing, that's the shadow, that's the thing that's always haunting you is, you know, when all knowledge is situated, how do you judge from one culture, for instance, to another? How do you judge imperialism? How do you judge Holocaust? It's hard. And cultural relativism is always there as a danger. And that was the argument used against postmodernism by liberals and Marxists. But, you know, Marxists are not allies with postmodernism. Postmodernism is a threat to pretty much everything that Marxism stands for. It's true that lots of people came from the Marxist tradition and sort of then came out of it to pose a threat to it. Of course, that's done with a couple of pretty cynical... Well, if he knows what he's talking about, it's cynical. And if he doesn't, it's worth it.
He doesn't appear to... I don't think he knows the difference between Derrida and Foucault, right? He had quite different ideas. Mm. I mean, he just thinks of them as sort of like this sort of... this big, giant Frenchman. Giant, scary Frenchman. And I mean, you know, listen, there's actually a good book called Myth and Mayhem, a leftist critique of Jordan Peterson, where people who are deeply immersed in Foucault and Marx and whatever point out what he's got wrong. And I found that quite useful. But I don't think you need to know any of that stuff. To get the basic contradiction that Marxism, which he hates and thinks inevitably leads to horror, there is no such thing. It's not like he thinks that was designed. It's equivalent to Nazism. That's the goal of Marxism and always will be. He thinks that he says, well, okay, well, the problem there is somebody imposing a grand narrative on history leading to utopia that must be achieved by kind of violence, which is a legit...
It's a good critique.
Critique, right? And then he attacks the postmodernists for going, there's no grand narrative of history. There is no moral certainty. And he's somehow taken these sort of opposing ideas about history and morality and said they're the same thing using this phrase postmodern neo-Marxist. So neo presumably meaning not. And he thinks that they are unbelievably powerful and evil. Now, I think maybe if you work in academia, you know, like if you spend all your time covering, say, university politics, you may well think, you know, the world is extremely left-wing. Mm. You might well think that. Yeah. You might hear some absolute crazy bullshit. But he doesn't appear to know. He's well-traveled. 160-city book tour, they boast about, right?
The kind of thing you and I can only dream of.
Yeah. Mm. So he...
Unless you count.
I can rest like 1.6. So he must know that this is not what the world is like. But he has this kind of thing, and this is where I think he speaks to something bigger about, I think, like what you call anti-woke thinking. One, amazing ignorance of the left and the fact that the left is full of people arguing with one another. Amazing ignorance of kind of even what the arguments are. And a complete lack of perspective. So in one of his books, there was a long bit, and he's brought this up before, about the flip chart controversy.
Yeah.
A patient who had a very hard time at a workplace because they decided there are all these words that should be banned because they're not used in the office because they're offensive. One is flip chart, because flip was apparently a derogatory term for Filipinos. Mm. Now, obviously, that's not what flip chart means. Mm-hmm. Like it's extremely stupid kind of speech code there. And he goes on and on and on about that. And yet he's very happy to visit Viktor Orban in Hungary, maybe to talk to him about flip charts. And like, if you had anything to do with the Soviets, if you're Marxist, if you said anything positive about Soviets, whatever, you are cursed. It's like you're dirty, stain. He goes, but Heidegger, who he references all the time with his being with a capital B, it's obviously quite good, was like an actual Nazi. Is that worthy of mention? No. So it's a mix of ignorance, conspiracy, hypocrisy, and in itself, it is an apocalyptic narrative. If it's like these people, I mean, I guess we're going back to the woke episode here, or conspiracy theories episode, these people are a force that will lead to literally mass murder. Mm. But he believes that. I don't think it's disingenuous. He believes, you know, he believes his wife has prophetic dreams. You know, so once again, I think it's really possible to go into great detail about what he gets wrong about zoology, what he gets wrong about Marxism. But that's because he's not trying to get it right. He's trying to give you a myth. If he was trying to get it right, he would not just have read the Communist Manifesto twice before going into an extremely public debate.
I just think we just keep on coming up to the same thing over and over, which is, you know, because we've had a serious gap, we maybe don't see it, but we've had two consecutive episodes of men who are fated as very intelligent, Elon Musk before, him now. And then when you actually see the stuff that they're saying, you're like, well, this is really sub-Wikipedia level knowledge that you're demonstrating right now. It's not like, you know, if you have Foucault, I disagree with lots of the stuff that Foucault writes, right? But the man is incredibly intelligent. Like those books, Discipline and Punish, is like a really satisfying intellectual fucking experience.
Right.
Like to go from that idea of this is what a smart person is to this, where once you scratch the surface of what's going on, you just find no attempt to do any research into anything at all. It's a really, really dispiriting
it's
experience.
It's the lack of the attempt. That's what's obvious.
Mm. Yes,
like,
exactly.
It's like, which Derrida books has he read? Which Foucault books has he read? Had he even read any biographies of those people if he doesn't want to read their books? Mm. There's a sense that he just hasn't, he's like, it's not necessary. His readers don't demand it, which is true, because this whole idea of postmodern neo-Marxism is extremely, very popular. It's kind of quite standard in the Republican Party, for example, and parts of the Tory Party, the National Conservatism Conference. So he's kind of right. You've got these poor left-wing academics out there going, well, actually, he's got Derrida wrong. And it's like, no, you're right. Nobody gives a shit.
You see, if he was just doing the politics stuff, comes up on Fox News or whatever the hell and chats about neo-Marxism, this kind of stuff really wouldn't bother. I mean, I see loads of people doing this all the time. They don't know what they're talking about. They're just a blowhard twat. And you're just like, okay, I don't have to watch that shit. And I really hope it goes away. What concerns me in his case is that it's combined with this kind of psychologist element where people are coming to him as an authority on something. And I think lots of these people are actually pretty alienated and pretty vulnerable. And he is then going to give them a series of messages that almost demonstrably will not improve and could actually make a real mess of their lives. And I think he then himself demonstrates that by what happens in between this book
and the next one.
Right, because we've been really hopping about. We've been quoting from Beyond Order as well. We've kind of just taken ideas from both there, because they're not that different. But what happens in his life is kind of crazy. And the darkness really comes out. And he does lots of interviews around the book, and obviously does this massive tour and podcasts and stuff. And he keeps contradicting his rules, right? So assume the person you were listening to might know something you don't. Never does that. Absolutely never does that. Be precise in your speech. He's not, as we see. He's called for enforced monogamy, and he went, oh, not enforced monogamy, right? So he says things, and then he goes, oh, I didn't really mean that. Don't be resentful, vengeful, or cruel. When Pankaj Mishra in the New York Review of Books related his ideas, his comparative mythology to the history of fascist mysticism, mm-hmm. Which, you know, was a problem with Jung and so on. Yeah. Peterson called him on Twitter an arrogant, racist son of a bitch and threatened to slap him. Right? So that's, he's not handled that so well. He said, right, don't be arrogant in your knowledge. Strive for humility. But then he told, I think, Helen Lewis, the only reason I haven't suffered an outrageous amount for my opinions is because I've handled the consequences of their utterance exceptionally well. Mm. Then 2019, not handling things so well. And to be fair, what the hell, right? So his wife, Tammy, is diagnosed with kidney cancer, which seemed terminal, although she has since recovered, but obviously very traumatic. His depression and anxiety come back in a big way. I think he kind of like, he's had depression for a long time. He's taking antidepressants. I think he treated them with dietary methods from 2016 onwards. Anyway, they all come back. He becomes addicted to the anti-anxiety medication benzodiazepine. He's also on the diet of nothing but meat, salt, and water, the so-called lion diet, which his daughter Michaela has been on. It cured her rheumatoid arthritis, which she suffered horribly from as a kid. Mm-hmm. That's in the books. And recommends for him. He's lost weight, he sleeps less, he works more. He's presenting all these as like good things. They, in some ways, they seem like unhealthy things. And then in summer 29, he disappears. So we get to another rule, rule 6 in the first book. Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. Oof, next book, Beyond Order, opens with Peterson waking up in a hospital in Moscow with no idea how he got there. It's basically saying to the reader, this is a self-help book, which starts with my total physical and mental and emotional collapse.
I just couldn't believe this bit when I read it. I was just, because I mean, I'm going through it chronologically, right? You know, I read the first book and out of nowhere, this stuff, we're just like, what the fuck? And the story itself is bizarre, by the way. I mean, you know, he's getting more and more addicted. He can't seem to taper the dosage. And so he goes into a clinic in Toronto and he's like, and that's my last memory. And then I wake up, you know, sometime later and I'm in a clinic in Moscow where my daughter has taken me. The clinic in Moscow is because they're going to do a procedure, which no one would do in the US, which is to put him into a medically induced coma so that he would go through the worst stages of withdrawal while in the coma. It's just like, are you sure that's a good idea, mate?
He thanks his doctors in the acknowledgements. So like he thought that was good.
This, by the way, when you start looking at the days that it's happening, you know, because you're starting sort of literally turn of the year, he's still coming, you know, in and out of consciousness until sort of early February in that place in Russia.
Yeah.
Again, of course, starts going on about his extremely vivid dreams. It's like, well, I'm not surprised by that. He goes off to Florida to recover, but actually the problems are still there. And by the time he ends that account, his daughter has come back to go like, well, maybe we should try this experimental procedure in Serbia. Like, are you not learning the fucking lesson here, which is maybe don't go for experimental procedures, you know, that involve being put into medically induced comas. I felt, reading this stuff, I felt odd because, you know, when you read the first book, you're very much like, this is the product of someone who is not well. Mm-hmm. And then you read this stuff and you're like, oh, no, you're really not well. You know, he has this sort of doctorly detached way of describing, I went off this drug and tried doing ketamine so that I could sleep and all of this. And you're like, mate. And this is coming, I mean, I really liked ketamine when I was younger. You know what I mean? Like, ketamine itself is not the problem, but you're just like, you are not in a place where you should be doing any kind of ketamine.
He said things like, didn't he say that he had an allergic reaction to sweet potato or whatever, which meant he didn't sleep for 3 weeks?
Yes.
So some of his accounts of his medical, because if you don't sleep 3 weeks, you die.
Well, they're also very questionable in their own. So he says, I had a sort of autoimmune problem because of a food. It's all very bizarre. And then you think, is it quite cruel to say, well, this seems like really quite conclusive evidence that your moral guide for life is not a very good way of living life. Hmm. And then I thought, well, fine, but if millions of people are reading this and taking something from it, they are entitled to come to conclusions on the basis of what is going on with you. And it speaks, I think, really profoundly to the essentialism, to that story he tells, you know, from the origin of order and chaos to being a man is this, whether you're a lobster or a human or a chimpanzee or anything else. It's such an unnatural and unhealthy way to live life, to say, because of designated category X, which I belong to, you know, whether I'm working class or gay or white or a man, I have to exhibit the following qualities and behave in a certain way, which in his case is basically living quite a fucking cold life. You know what I mean? Like always being strong, always being tough. He hates this idea of like, never allow yourself to be dependent. He complains about dependency. That is for him being a girly man. And you see it come up again and again when he describes how he feels during these processes in the clinics. It's about being, I couldn't handle it because I was dependent, because I was depending on my daughter and my wife. And you think, well, that's okay.
One of the pieces in this book called Critical Responses to Jordan Peterson, broadly sympathetic. One contributor writes, after this, like literally, I think last year, having survived his trials, Jordan Peterson continues to be a courageous exemplar of flourishing 21st century humanity.
Oof, like I'm put down.
Now, clearly, some people think that, you know, and I'm not at all ignoring the fact that he has tens of thousands of letters and people who found that his advice on YouTube tutorials and his books or whatever have really helped them. Have helped them to kind of reconcile with family members or to get promotions or whatever. Okay, great. Like if I don't disbelieve that at all. I just don't quite know. One, I don't quite know how they got that from these books. I mean, that's my failing. And two, what he has become since then is like his public image is of a maniac. And I don't mean in a mental health sense. I mean like in a cinematic sense. Like he's constantly, it's rage and contempt and sobbing and threatening people while dressed in a style I can only describe as riddle me this, Batman. It's so wildly eccentric. Everything is like insane and, you know, appalling and vile. And he lives at this kind of manic pitch, whatever's going on with his the diet or medication. He's clearly living at this pitch. He said his next book will be called Wrestling with God. So I don't know who would win that one. So what is it? Is the appeal all the things that I don't like? Which is perfectly possible. There's lots of things that I don't like that are very popular, and the reasons I don't like them is why they're popular.
I mean, look, we've said the basics. He at least used to come across well with a sort of sense of academic heft and a real broadness to the historical and intellectual references that he could make while representing a kind of classic, kind of, you know, conservative reactionary point of view on things like pronouns and the general culture war, you know, detritus around us. So therefore, he was appealing on TV. I think the crucial part is someone speaking to men and boys. I do think that's fundamental here. That level of success, and this is to me, you know, when we started the first episode 10,000 years ago, my thing was like, there is something really profound for progressives to learn here. And I think there's two ways of looking at it. One of them could be strategically. You could say, okay, fine. So we're going to treat it like a flash in the pan. It doesn't matter. It's the classic old reactionary shit. We put it back in its box and it'll go away. And then you see, no, it ends up with Andrew Tate. You know, if you don't actually start having something to say in these conversations, it goes to a much darker place than certainly than the stuff that we've been talking about over the last, you know, couple of hours. But the other is the moral view, which is that there is a group that isn't really that is experiencing in certain areas quite precise difficulties. And that your thing to say to people like that, typically to alienated young men, should be something which doesn't damage them, which isn't, don't be a girly girl, be this thing, be tough, be cold, be distant. It has to be that your sense of strength and resilience in your character should exist irrespective of whether that is something that is socially accepted or whether it's a cultural norm or whether it's what people think a man should be or a woman should be or anything else. That your only true path to happiness and confidence is to be who you really are rather than who society or tradition tells you to be. That is a better, healthier story. But ultimately, I think to realize that you have to tell it is to realize that there is something profound in the extent of the demand that he exhibited with the book. And that, not the content of it, but the reception to it, is, I think, the really important thing here.
Doran, what do you think? What have you taken from this two-hour expedition into the dark heart of man?
I'm going to start with the books, right? I think the appeal of his books is a weirdly potent cocktail that you wouldn't necessarily guess would be potent before it became so successful. So he dispenses fairly obvious advice wrapped in familiar stories and highbrow references that feel clever. So you get Pinocchio, but you also get Kierkegaard. Then there's a paradoxical blend, I mentioned earlier, of this hard rationalism and mysticism. So sometimes he's trying to sound like Richard Dawkins, and sometimes he's sounding like Joseph Campbell. And this is a contradiction that doesn't seem to have been an obstacle. But James Marriott in The Times, interestingly, he had some friends in their 20s who liked Jordan Peterson. And he said the appeal was similar to that of tarot cards and astrology.
Oh, interesting.
Not, you know, hard science about human biology. And unlike most self-help writers, he says that life is a struggle. And I think that really does convey toughness and honesty. It's not about being happy as such, which virtually all self-help books are about, because he doesn't really believe in happiness. He's clearly not happy, but he almost believes that you can't be, and that this is a foolish goal. And I think that is something really quite original in this vein, certainly not in philosophy,
sure,
but in this sort of popular self-help vein, is going, no, life is really hard and full of pain and there are no easy answers. He's just launched the Peterson Academy, by the way, $4,000 unaccredited course, which I imagine will have quite a lot of this stuff.
Jesus, wow.
If anyone's got a $4,000 spare. But the problem is, of course, is that we can't talk just about the books, because what he has become is a full-time culture warrior and I would say crank. I mentioned the videos earlier. He's very active on Twitter, tweets several times a day in furious free verse. Have you seen the way that he does this? They kind of look like odd poems. So before this recording, in the past week or so, I kind of just scanned through the timeline to see. He has done the following, right? He has attacked Net Zero, 15 Minute Cities, and trans people, supported Russell Brand, Suella Braverman, Lawrence Fox, and RFK Jr., called Justin Trudeau a sad excuse for a worm, and The Guardian the world's most sickening rag, denied the existence of gay conversion therapy, tried to launch a boycott of Burger King because it would no longer advertise on Russell Brand's Rumble channel, compared a Braun Shaver ad, which features a trans person, to the work of the Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele, and claimed that the communists were obviously far worse than the Nazis. So that's who he is now. There is the Peterson of the books, and even beyond order, he's not in free verse, thank God. And he's not going off on one about all these different issues. But that is his media profile now. That is where a lot of his following is coming from. And that's what makes me wonder what the people who hailed him as an intellectual 5 years ago make of it all, because he might have taken a different path. Like someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, right? Had a huge breakthrough bestseller. And he came off social media, went off to do his own thing, write comic books, write novels, like decided that he did not want to become a warrior, a pundit, somebody who constantly lives through the internet. And I think that was very, very wise. Whereas Peterson seems to have been swallowed by this idea that people need to hear from him about everything all the time. And to go back to these books through that prism, I think you end up reading between the lines and going, okay, well, what is he not saying in this passage where he's trying to seem reasonable?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in conclusion, I think five and a half years after I first wrote about him, I still don't like him. After reading his books, perhaps I like him less, but I feel a little sadder for him because he seems to be suffering a great deal.
That's true. And I think, you know, that's a kind of a fine point to end it on, because it's quite a strange emotional feeling reading something, getting increasingly cross with someone, but also simultaneously feeling more and more sorry for them. And that's ultimately what the experience of reading these books is like. You do ultimately come away from it thinking, yeah, I'm really glad I'm not in your headspace.
I'd like to read a book in which he actually follows all of his rules. I'd love to read a book in which there is more listening. There is more humility. There is understanding that perhaps there are different readings of Pinocchio.
Why don't we create a reality TV show which he will star in, where we follow him around with a camera, and every time he does something that's against one of his 24 rules, yeah, we have a massive red button that makes a tremendous noise and he has to correct himself.
I think it's terrific. I think he would be up for that.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah, and we'll go find him in Serbia.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Origin Story. You can see all of our sources in the show notes and give us feedback via the Patreon page or at Origin Storycast on Twitter.
Please sign up and be a patron. Patrons get all sorts of gifts and goodies, and they get each episode 1 week early. So right now, in your inboxes, if you're a patron, you'll be getting next week's episode, which is on boomers.
Thank you so much for your support. It makes it all worthwhile. All 24 rules were worth reading. See you next time.
Origin Story Season 4 is written and presented by Ian Dunt and Dorian Linsky. The lead producer is Anne-Marie Luff, and the audio producer was me, Simon Williams. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. Music is by Jade Bailey, and art direction is by James Parrott and Misha Welsh. Origin Story is a Podmasters production.